الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وجل فرجه
وعلى أعدائهم أجمعين من الأولين والآخرين، آمين يا رب العالمين. السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله وعلى الأرواح التي حلت بفنائك، عليك مني جميعا سلام الله أبدا ما بقيت، وبقي الليل والنهار، ولا جعل الله آخر الأهد مني لزيارتكم. السلام على الحسين وعلى علي بن الحسين وعلى أولاد الحسين وعلى أصحاب الحسين. السلام عليكم جميعا ورحمة الله وبركاته.
وعليكم السلام ورحمة الله وبركاته.
Inshallah, with Allah's grace, we will try and continue on these subjects that we have embarked upon on these special nights of Muharram. But before we go on, I just want to ask everyone to try something. You know, in the night after Fajr prayer, just a small advice from your small brother. And I'm sure most of you do this already. I want you, inshallah, after Fajr prayer today, to open the book of Mafatih al-Janan. If you have it in English, so much the better if you don't know Arabic. I want you to open it to Ziyarat Ashura. And I want you to read Ziyarat Ashura. Not necessarily in Arabic. If you can read it in Arabic, so much the better if you understand. But if you don't understand the Arabic, the important thing is understand the meaning of Ziyarat Ashura. We could sit down over here for months, years, decades, and still only glaze over what is Ziyarat Ashura. Inshallah, one of my intentions on the day of Ashura over here, if Allah gives me the tawfiq, is when we do the musibah of Aba Abdullah al-Hussein, and I pray Allah gives me the tawfiq to be able to do this, because I want to try and do the musibah of Ziyad Nahiyah, which is the musibah of how Imam Mahdi makes musibah for Imam Hussein. Inshallah, all of you have the tawfiq to recite Ziyad Ashura tomorrow morning. Reflect on it, think on it, and you will open, you'll have your eyes opened in a way that previously maybe you didn't. And this advice is not just for you, it is for me as well. Salawat.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
So on our subject, which is patience, but we will take it in a slightly interesting angle. Yesterday we were talking about the situation of Muslim bin Aqil when he arrived into Kufa, when he arrived into the home of Mukhtar al-Thaqafi. And of course Mukhtar was the first person to make bay'ah to Imam Hussein at the hand of Muslim. And he realized the maqam of Muslim, who is the na'ib of the Imam of his time. The na'ib, the representative of the Imam of his time. Of course, Muslim is not the Imam of his time, but his position as a representative, as someone who is working for the Imam, is almost like unto the Imam. It's not the same as the Imam, but it's almost the same. So much so that if Muslim tells Mukhtar, you must do X, then Mukhtar's responsibility is to do X, without question. The same way, like the Imam, if the Imam tells Mukhtar or myself or you or anyone to do X, then our responsibility is to, of course, do X without question, even if it's something we don't like. After a short while, after Muslim had been staying in the home of Mukhtar for some time, and he had had many meetings with the Zu'ama of Kufa, and with the people of Kufa, and the people of Kufa were coming to visit him, to give bay'ah to him, to speak to him, to obtain advice for him, because of course, like I said, he's the na'ib of the Imam, One of his tasks, one of his duties, is to help the people, to give them rulings in fiqh, to help them in all these matters. After a while, it became dangerous and it became problematic for people to visit him at Mukhtar's house, because Mukhtar was very well known. Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad and all of the Umayyin, they knew Mukhtar was a follower of Imam Ali. They knew the stance of Mukhtar. Mukhtar was not someone who sort of hid behind any sort of, I suppose, maybe the word is diplomacy. He was very clear that his allegiance is to Imam Ali, and now his allegiance is to Abu Abdullah al-Hussein. He didn't make any sort of confusion about that in any way. Everyone knew. But because of the way Mukhtar was, because of the strength of Mukhtar, not necessarily the physical strength, but the strength of his character, the honor, the sharaf that he had. And this sharaf doesn't come just like this. This sharaf comes when you work for Allah, Allah gives you that sharaf. In Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "In tansurullah yansurkum wa yuthabbit aqdamukum." That if you work for Allah, then Allah will help you. And if you help Allah, Allah will help you and He will make your footsteps strong. He will make you solid. Even if you're in a difficult situation, the whole sky is falling down around you, everything is difficult. Imagine, like the brother was saying earlier about Sayyid Hassan in 2006 in Lebanon. You can imagine what was happening, the way the Israelis, may Allah inshallah remove them, the way the Israelis were bombing Lebanon, the way they were killing Shia. I have a very good friend, two very good friends, people I used to work with, they became shaheed in that war. One of them was inside his office. We used to make videos for Nasheed. We used to make videos for Nasheed, we used to make subtitles for them, and we used to put them on the internet for the brothers and sisters. This brother was working on one Nasheed. He was in an office, we thought the area was okay. Next thing I know, I'm seeing the building is flattened. One other brother, his name was Bashir Alawiyyah. Bashir was, he was a poet, he was a trainer in martial arts and, like, you know, exercise and stuff like this. And his main job, he was an engineer. His qualification, he was an engineer. And no one, not even his wife, he'd been married 3 months only when he became shaheed. No one, even his mother, no one knew that he was from the Mujahideen. Nobody knew. When Harb Tammuz, when the 2006 war started, Bashir told his family, "I'm going to the south." His family said, "Why are you going to the south?" He said, "I'm just going to see some friends." And if you see him, if you had ever had the honor to meet someone like Bashir, you yourself would not think this is a mujahid. He didn't look like, you know, like a hard man or anything. He was small, he was tall, he was, you know, fit in that way, he was healthy. But he didn't look like someone, you know, the picture you have when you think of a Hezbollah Mujahid, you think of someone who is, like, you know, proper built and, you know, maybe like the cameraman, someone like this. And whenever I see our cameraman, I think, subhanAllah, this is one of the Mujahideen. But Bashir, he was very small, he was very thin, he was, you know, normal. And he went to the south and he made a phone call to one of my close friends and to myself. And phone call was just, "Salaamu Alaikum, how are you?" I'm thinking, why is this man phoning me? He's in, like, Lebanon, sky is falling. He's just phoning me, "How are you? Salaamu Alaikum, you know, what's going on? What's happening in England?" It was like a normal call, subhanAllah. Within 2 days, I got news from one of the other brothers in Beirut that we've just received news that Bashir is missing. So what do you mean he's missing? So we don't know, this is the only thing we got. Hezbollah, when they communicate in a war situation, they communicate with SMS. It's the easiest way to get information because it's a big community. Even over here, if we want to get a quick message out, SMS, blah, 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 it's gone. And people will know what's going on. So Hezbollah, they communicate with SMS as well. Salawat.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali.
So every day, you know, messages would come that this person is missing, or this person has become shaheed, or, you know, news of what's going on. Not every day, literally every 10 minutes, every 15 minutes, especially during that time. That night, my friend Hadi had a very interesting dream. And I'd like to narrate that dream for you. There is a reason why I'm giving you this narration, but it's also nice to make zikr of shuhada. There is, especially in these months, especially shuhada who are, you know, of course, shuhada of Karbala have their own maqam. These are shuhada who we can touch, we can feel these shuhada. They're like us, if you like. Hadi had a very interesting dream. In this dream, he saw Bashir, and Bashir was looking very happy, very relaxed, very calm. He was sitting down. Bashir had a habit of, some of the youngsters, I think they must do this, he used to do shisha, the pipe they smoke. Bashir had a big habit on that. That's not to say it's a good habit. If you do it, then you should probably stop. But anyway, he was sitting down, he had the pipe in the dream, and he's, you know, when Hadi came, Bashir told him, come sit down with me. How are you? How is everything? How is the battle going? What's going on, man? Where are you? How is the battle going? You don't know? We're getting flattened. What's going on? And Bashir tells him that, look, I have already exited the battle. I'm out. I've been taken away. I've achieved what I wanted to achieve. But I want you to tell Ahmed Fallah, who is another one of our friends, that he will be soon coming with me. I've had this news that Ahmed Fallah will be coming to see me soon. Ahmed Fallah was a slightly senior gentleman. He was, from all of us friends, he was the oldest one. He was maybe close to late 40s, early 50s, something like this. And he was he used to make bread. He had a baker shop. He used to make bread and pastries and like this. So Hadi is thinking, Ahmed Fallah? Ahmed is the one, you know, he's... What's going on? Anyway, when Hadi woke up, he had some texts that had arrived on his phone. And one of those texts, the last one that had come, they said that Ahmed Fallah's shop, which was quite famous in that area, in Dahia, in the southern suburbs, it had been flattened and Ahmed was inside it. Now, the reason why I narrated this story is that this maqam of shuhada, this maqam of being close to Allah, is a special sharaf that only us as Shia can obtain. This is special for Shia. Of course, other people, other honorable people, they have their own. But for us, because we have this Karbala'i spirit, this Karbala'i power going through our veins, this Karbala'i fire inside our hearts, that's all the time there, whatever the case. Because we have this fire teaches us to work in a particular way. It compels us to listen to those people who are more learned than us in terms of our day-to-day activities. It tells us that in the absence of the Imam, we have a duty to follow certain people. Not because these people are, you know, we love them just like this, but because these people are qualified, because these people are educated, and because Imam Mahdi, ajallahu ta'ala, farajhu sharif, has told us very, very clearly in the letter that he gave for us, for you and me, where he said, and I'm paraphrasing, that O believers, O mu'mineen, after I go into Raybat-e-Kubra, after I go into the greater occultation, you will not have direct communication with me. It will not be possible to have direct communication with me until Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala allows me to come back. Oh my Shia, I want to come back. that Allah will not let me come back until you are prepared, until your situation is correct and your level is correct, so that when we meet, we are able to achieve that divine perfection upon this earth. And that when Imam Mahdi has this duty of تَمْلَأُ الْأَرْضَ قِسْطًا وَعَدْلًا كَمَا مُلِيَ الظُّلْمًا وَجَوْرًا, that he will fill the earth with justice and equality and goodness as it is filled with injustice and tyranny. He said, during this time of Naybata Kubra, this is a training time for you. This is a lesson time for you. And I'll come back to Kufa and explain the connect in a moment. This is a training time for you. During this time, you have a responsibility. You have a responsibility that for your activities, whether they are business-related activities, private-related activities, sports-related activities, every activity, family-related activities, every activity that you do, every activity that you do, you must seek guidance regarding this. Any aspect which falls into the furu' ad-deen, you must take guidance from this. And Imam told us who we take guidance from. Because not everyone is capable of knowing Arabic, for example. Arabic as a language is a complex language. It is one of the most, it is the most perfect language. It is the most perfect language in every single way. That doesn't mean other languages are bad. It just means that this is the language that is the most perfect. There is, in Arabic, there is no ambiguity. Arabic is one of the few languages where it talks about, when you talk about, for example, I have one cup. If I have two cups, in Arabic there is a dual tense. This doesn't exist in English. In English, I either have a cup or I have cups. In Arabic, I would have ka'as, which is for one cup. If I have two ka'as, I don't say two ka'as, I say ka'asin. And then there is a plural. Salawat. And that is not all. In Arabic, after the language, there are rules of balagha, rules of eloquence. Because when things like the Quran came, when a hadith were written and scribed by the muhaddithin, when they were spoken by the imams, or if they're hadith qudsi, when they were delivered and given to the prophet so that they were scribed by the muhaddithin for the people's benefit, they came with a certain level of eloquence. One of the reasons why we say that Quran is the miracle of Islam, some non-Muslim people, they say, how can a book be a miracle? What are you people talking about? Many non-Muslims, you know, sadly, they say that, how can a book be the miracle? The book can be the miracle if you look at the context in two ways. First of all, if you look at the time when Quran was revealed, in that time, in Arabia, the Arabs, they were the most jahil people on earth. Of course, we know this. This is ma'ruf, this is very well known. They were the lowest of the low, they were the worst people. But one sifat they had was that they were very eloquent in poetry. They would have debates with each other through poetry, through prose. They would discuss with each other, even in terms of like a battle. When anyone went to a battle, they would initially introduce themselves with a small sonnet, a couple of couplets. Even in Karbala, if you actually read books like Nafs al-Mahmum or Lahuf or Abu Mikhnaf, the actual books of the Maqtab in Arabic, you will see that there are these couplets that were said. There are famous couplets that were said, for example, by Zuhair ibn Qayn. He has some very famous ones. Even if you listen, there are couplets that were said by Shah Qasim, the son of Imam Hassan. You have couplets that were said by Ali al-Akbar, You have couplets that were said, of course, by Abu Abdullah Hussein. There are famous salawats. This was the way that the people worked in those times. Of course, in England, they don't do this. You know, in England or in America, if they want to go to war, they don't even go to the country. They have a PlayStation, and they have a drone that Mr. Obama has, and he switches on the PlayStation, puts the DVD in, puts his headphones on, and says, okay, who am I going to bomb today? And he goes off, and sadly, he goes and kills some of our people in Pakistan, or he kills some of our people in Yemen, or he gives it to Israel to kill some of our children in Palestine, and everywhere. Nowadays, that honor in battle is gone. There is no honor. There is no sharaf. There is no bravery. There is no chivalry. Now it's the PlayStation battles. But back in those times, things were different. Poetry was one of the most powerful art forms. In fact, it was the absolute powerful art form of that time, of that era. If Rasulullah had come, for argument's sake, with the asa of Musa to the people of Jahiliyyah, to the Arabs of Jahiliyyah, of course it would have had an effect. A mu'ajiza, regardless of what the mu'ajiza is, will have an effect upon the hearts of the people, without any doubt. But in order to have a lasting effect that literally blows the mind of these people, of these mushrikeen, Allah gave Rasul a miracle that they just couldn't cope with. They just didn't know how to fight against this. And they would say, there are actually, I was reading just earlier on today in Tariq al-Tabari, which is one of the famous books of history. It's something like 40, 45 volumes. And it has a history of everything from the time of Nabi Adam all the way till the end of the dynasties of the Abbasiyin, I believe. And it's quite detailed, and it's available in English. You can get it in English. Unfortunately, it's not something that's online, so you have to buy it. But I was looking through this whole thing, and I was looking through a few things. And there's one quote which comes from someone who we have a great deal of resentment and hate and disgust for, because of what this person did. The person I'm talking about is the mother of Muawiyah, who we call him the Jigarhar. May Allah lower her position even more. She says one day her and Abu Sufyan are sitting, and this is in Mecca, just at the beginning when Rasulullah has started telling people the ayat after Ba'that, after he's made the open announcement that, you know, قُلُوا لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا اللَّهُ تُفْلِحُونَ, that say لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا اللَّهُ and you will be saved. After that time, they are sitting, Abu Sufyan and his wife. And it's like the picture that the hadith gives, it's almost like a picture, you know, Abu Sufyan sitting there, hen sitting there, you know, combing her hair or whatever it is she's doing. And they're like scratching their head and thinking, where the hell is Muhammad getting his words from? How can a man go into the mountain one day and come back down blazing with poetry? Hind is saying this. Even the enemies, the absolute enemies, Hind never for one second became a friend. Not even in the eyes of the most silly of persons. Even the enemy is doing faza'il of this mu'jiza of Allah. It's very interesting. Now, because Sallallahu Alaihi Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. Now, because Quran came in this fashion, with this level of eloquence, in order for you and me to learn Quran, to be able to understand it, to be able to learn and understand the hadith, and not just that, in the books of hadith, one of the biggest problems that we have is that not every hadith is correct. We, the Shia, we do not have a book of hadith that is Sahih Shia. We do not have this. We have many books of hadith, many, many more than our brothers. And of course, I'm not saying the books of our brothers are necessarily completely correct either. Yeah, please do not misunderstand me again. But our books, on the record, and this is well known, our books are laced with hadith that are weak, in some cases downright wrong. According to one of my teachers, and this is his opinion, and I'm quoting his opinion, he said maybe 90% of the hadith that we as Shia have are invalid. But the problem is, someone like me or you can't work out which hadith is the one that's correct or the one that's broken, for many reasons. If I look at a hadith, and this hadith appeals to me, is something which makes me feel nice, this looks nice, I can't say this hadith is correct. The correctness of a hadith does not come from whether Shabir likes it, or Ahmed Bai likes it, or anyone else likes it. It comes from two things, several things. First, the transmission chain, that I heard X from Y, from Z, from Rasul, or from Imam, or like this. The chain of narration needs to be valid. If in the middle of that chain of narration, you have someone who is a mischief monger, someone who is known to be someone who makes trouble, he likes doing it, he kind of enjoys, you know, some people, they enjoy making trouble, right? So if there's someone like that in that chain, then that hadith has to be, you have to sort of put a red circle around it and say, okay, we need to look into this a bit more detail. Sometimes there are hadith which have been narrated by a liar. Sometimes you have hadith which is such and such person said from such and such person, and then you have no names. I heard from this person sitting in the park on Thursday morning. I'm paraphrasing, there are no hadith that talk like that yet. But I'm just giving an example for our benefit. When we see hadiths like this, it's impossible for you and me to sit down and deduce whether this given hadith is valid or it's something that is not valid. It's not possible for us. This is our shortcoming. Because research of this level, when you have hadith of so many hadith, it takes a lifetime of commitment. It's not something that happens, you know, someone like me goes to Hamza for a few years, MashaAllah, I put the amama, oh well, I was given the amama, khalas. You go and khalas, I can, you know, understand every single hadith. No, that's not how it works. That's not how it works. Someone goes to university, learns Arabic, khalas, suddenly they know all the hadiths. No. And after even the chain of narration, that's one aspect. The second aspect is that the hadith must not conflict with Quran. Imam Sadiq salamullahi alayhi, Imam Sadiq taught us, and he is the founder of our school, the Ja'fariya school. All of our rulings in fiqh, in the various sciences that allow us to understand, even things like medicine within the Shia, Tibb al-Aim and stuff like this, all of this was formulated and captured and formalized, if you like, by Imam Sadiq. Of course, it was there in the times of the Imams before him. But Imam Sadiq and Imam Baqir, they formalized this. And they created one of these institutions called the Madrasa, like the university, you could say, which today we refer to like the Hawza. And they provided, the Ma'soom Imam provided us the rules. So they provided us things like baseline rules on Usul al-Fiqh. What are the principles of determining fiqh rulings? They gave us understanding on things like mantiq, logic. Logic, mathematics, form a very important part of the determining of rules in fiqh. In anything, logic is very important. If I turn around to anyone and I say, I cannot not do this, it's a double negative, yes? I cannot not do this. Simple example. It's double negative. But if someone doesn't know logic to a deep depth, if there is a slightly more complex sentence with maybe a double negative, or a triple negative, or 10 negatives, then that person will become confused. And he'll say, is this person saying he can do that? Can't he do that? What's going on? I don't understand. It doesn't make any sense to me. You know? Now, and this is also important in understanding the hadith, because sometimes hadiths have very, the way they're written is quite ajib, it's quite strange. Again, that doesn't make the hadith right or wrong, it just makes it strange. And that means I have to go and research it. Salawat. And on top of all of that, after even, let's say, we've sat down, or someone who has studied, obviously, has sat down and analyzed a particular hadith, and everything is good about the hadith. I'm giving an argument, I'm giving a very trivial example for the sake of argument. I don't want anyone to think that I'm actually talking about a hadith like this. It's an example, hypothetical. Let's say there is a hadith that we have found which says that you must pray for Fajr 67 rak'ah. For example, no one should pray 67 rak'ah, Fajr is 2 rak'ah. So make that very clear. I feel I have to clarify things now. Salat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So let's say we have all sat down and we're analyzing a hadith. And we are told the hadith comes from one of the ma'sumin. We don't know who. A ma'sum. Ma'sum X, for example. One of the Jabba ma'sumin. And this hadith is narrated by X, Y, Z, you know, many, many different people. And we feel that this hadith is okay. We've gone to some senior alims who understand about each of the individuals who transmitted the hadith, everything. And we feel that this hadith is okay. But the hadith says, Fajr should be 67 rak'ah. We then have to go back into Quran. If the hadith, Imam Sadiq taught us one of the most important rules, if a hadith conflicts with Quran, take it and throw it on the wall. Even if it is the most accurate hadith in terms of every other condition. But if it contradicts Quran, even in one teensy little way, it's garbage. How is that possible? First of all, Quran is the absolute baseline. Quran, we know, our belief tells us that this is Kitabun Maknun. It is a protected book. Quran is a protected book. That doesn't mean that just the physical printed stuff is protected. Of course, we have a certain duty, La yamassuhu illa mutahharun, that you mustn't touch Quran until you have wudu, until you are in a state of tahara. You mustn't let any bad things happen to Quran. You must always treat Quran with the most ihtiram, absolute ihtiram. But Quran's protection, the Quran Samit, the Quran that is the book, the quiet Quran. The book Quran doesn't sort of open its voice and speak to you, right? It's there. We have to open it and read and do something and learn and benefit. The Quran Samit, the quiet Quran, is protected by Quran and Natiq, the speaking Quran, the Quran that can talk. And we also know what this speaking Quran is, because we, alhamdulillah, we are blessed in this school of Ahlul Bayt. Wallahi, there is not a human being alive who is more blessed than someone in this school. This is a humongous sharaf that we have been able to have the tawfiq to be within this school. This is not something small. We should go to our parents, to our teachers, and kiss their foreheads that they have given us this system. And our elders should go to the graves of their parents and their teachers and make a fatiha and make a surat yaseen for them. Because this is a silsila. It is a chain that has come from before. It's not for everyone. That doesn't mean it's exclusive. Again, I need to clarify, I don't want people to misunderstand. It's not something which is exclusive, like, you know, like, يعني, like Bani Israel, we are the chosen people. No. Anyone who is mukhlis, anyone who is mu'min, can become into this school. And today when we do the musibah, we will talk about someone who in the beginning was not in this way. But when he died, it was said about him that you are free in this world and you are free in the next. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala So all of these conditions need to be applied to even understand one hadith. You have to know Quran, you have to know tafaseer of Quran, you have to know the language of Quran inside out. You have to know mantiq inside out at very high levels. You have to know usul, you have to know usul al-fiqh, you need to know kalam, you need to know falsafa, you need to know a load of other sciences before you can even begin to say that, okay Shabir, you know all of this now. This one hadith, our hadith of 67 ayah, we can now go and determine whether this hadith is actually accurate or it's something which is rubbish. It is not something, I don't know about you, but for me, I do not have the ability to analyze to that level. And I do not have the courage to just take a hadith as I feel, which feels nice to me, and say, okay, I feel like we're saying 67 raka'ah in Fajr, khalas, I'm going to do 67 raka'ah in Fajr. I like praying, 67 is a nice round number, I will do 67 raka'ah for Fajr. I don't have the strength to make that type of deduction. So what do I do? Imam Mahdi ajallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif. Like all of the Imams before him, like Rasulullah, knows us and has a wilaya upon us which is greater than our own, which is greater than our mothers and our fathers. And they know us better than we know ourselves. And this is why, out of love, and this was nothing except love, this was the purest of love, Imam Mahdi, with Allah's permission of course, gave us a system. Gave us a system, a mechanism, that allows us to go about our normal business, to have our normal job, for me to be a computer programmer, for example, for the brothers in front of me to be students, for yourself to be a trainer, for someone to have a shop, whatever business we have in our day to day. But to still be able to follow those commands from those thousands of hadith, from all of the ayat of Quran, and do so fully securing the knowledge that I am following this and I don't need to worry. How can we be so sure about this? Because Imam Mahdi ajallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif, told us that, oh my Shia, he's talking to you and me. Stop talking to anyone else. He's talking to you and me. After my ghaybata kubra, when you have a question regarding an issue, then I want you to go and refer to the faqih, the jurist, the scientist, the alim, who has certain conditions. Not just any old alim. Because remember, these clothes, you can buy them anywhere. The clothes an alim do not make. The clothes an alim do not make. It is what is beneath those clothes, and that is wrapped in the heart. And that is wrapped in the heart that the alim makes. This is very important. So he told us, go and reference when you have questions on issues. Go and reference the fuqaha who protect their deen, who protect their privacy in terms of their sharaf, their honor, who don't dishonor themselves in any way, and many, many conditions. And after he gave all of these conditions, he said, and oh my people, know one thing. These fuqaha are a hujjah upon you, are a proof upon you. And I, meaning Imam Mahdi, is a proof upon the fuqaha. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is a proof on Imam Mahdi. This chain, this silsila, is unbroken. The connect is straight to Allah, but through a mechanism. Now, I ask you, and I will move to the Masail in 2 minutes, if that's okay. Okay, in 5 minutes, inshallah. Give me a loud salawat, please.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad
wa ajil farajah.
Now, when we are told by Imam that, oh, you Shia, when you have an issue, go to the fuqaha with such and such qualifications, such and such credentials, such and such qualities, and know that they are a hujjah upon you, a proof upon you, and that I am a proof upon them, and that Allah is a proof upon the Mahdi. When you know that, then something powerful happens. Something truly amazing happens. You understand a very, very important thing. If Allah is the proof upon Imam, this gives the Imam that infallibility, that isma, that inability to make a mistake. Imam Mahdi is the hujjah upon the fuqaha. Imam Mahdi's hujjah on the fuqaha is not the same as Allah's hujjah. Only Allah's hujjah can make someone ma'soom. Only Allah's hujjah can make someone ma'soom. But Imam Mahdi's hujjah brings someone to the door of Islam. Doesn't let them through. That door will not open except for certain people, 14 special people. But they get close to the door so they can bask in its glory. They can feel the heat from the door. Imagine you're inside a room. You have a house with two rooms, for example. I'm talking about, like, you know, back in Iran we have small houses. Now it's different. You have a house, you know, made of just standard, like, concrete or brick. And it's a cold winter's day, and you have one heater. Your heater is in one room, you have the wife and the family inside that room. And you have some brothers who have come, so of course, obviously we don't have this type of mixed situations in the house. And so your brothers are sitting there. You will make sure that your brothers, to be comfortable, will be sitting near the door where the heater is. Not because they can see the heater, but because that door will be warm and they will feel the effect of that heat. And because they are your mihman, your guests, you will give them that honor and you will take, you know, you will put a sweater on and you will sit down. You might moan about it, but that's the way we are. Now, the same way, the hujjah of Imam Mahdi, the hujjah of Imam Mahdi upon the fuqaha, who have certain qualifications and certain conditions. Not anyone who says, I'm a faqih. Not anyone who says, I'm a faqih. Tomorrow, if Shabir, na'uzu billah, has a lobotomy and goes to everyone and says, I am Ayatollah Shabir. I'm not, I'm only giving an example, please, I know it's on camera. Right? I'm not, I'm less than the dirt of anything. But let's assume someone decides he's going to call himself Ayatollah X. This doesn't make that person anything. This is cheap. Talk is cheap. A person becomes a... You know, I'm digressing a little bit, but this is important. The titles that we have for the ulama, we have titles like what? Hujjat al-Islam, Ayatollah, Ayatollah al-Udhma, Allama, etc. These titles have a certain understanding. They have a certain ma'rifah. They are there for a reason. And of course, they are also based on the level. So for example, in a university system, you will have someone who has done an undergraduate degree, they'll be a BA, for example. Someone who's done their first postgraduate degree will be an MA. Someone who's done a doctorate will be a PhD. Someone who's done multiple, he'll become professor. And the professor is like the highest, the most educated level, if you like. For us, in the Hausa system, it's similar. But the words that I use, the titles that I use, are also different. Hujjat al-Islam is the first level. Hujjat al-Islam is someone who has studied for a certain amount of time, has received certain qualifications, but a Hujjat al-Islam does not have the ability to do ijtihad, not even by the stretch of any imagination. He is a mujtahid. He is a muqallid, rather. He is a muqallid. A Hujjat al-Islam, 9 times out of 10, or 9.5 times out of 10, will be a muqallid. He is not a mujtahid. You then have Ayatollah. Ayatollah are like people, if you like, they've done postgraduate and they've done a PhD. And they're beginning to specialize in certain subjects. At that point, that Ayatollah may be in a position where they can operate on one of two ways. Depending on their level of knowledge and where they are within the rank of Ayatollah, they may be able to do their own taqlid. It's possible. Or they may be able to operate on ihtiyat. Now, for the benefit of those who don't understand, ihtiyat is probably one of the hardest ways to operate. You have to know the rulings of all of that maraji, and you have to take the path that is the most difficult, not the most easiest. It is the path that is the most difficult. But in order for you to be able to do and determine that path, you have to first know all of the rulings of all of the maraji. It's a very difficult line. And I know maybe one person who went down that line for a short time, and then he said, I can't do this, and he came back to the plate. He couldn't carry on, and this was someone senior, this was a 60-year-old guy, one of my asatid. He couldn't do it. Because the level of difficulty to operate on ihtiyat is amazing. After a person has been a mujtahid for a while, for a significant time, and they've done more and more and more and more and more research, when the Jami al-Mudarrisin, which is like the college of teachers, if you like, the college of teachers of the Hausa, the heads of the Hausa, if you like, the deans, if you like, if we want to use university terminology, they all examine the works of a given alim who has crossed the boundary of Ayatollah. And they look at his fatawi, and they examine his rulings. He has to write certain commentaries on certain books, like Urwat al-Wuthqa and Tahrir al-Wasila. And he has to start working on these type of very complex things, not things that are straightforward. And I know it's a little bit dry, but these are important things for us to know. Salawat. When that faqih is determined by Jami al-Mudarrisin to be at the level that it is possible to follow him, at that point it is possible for that person to publish his book, his Risala Amaliyya, his Articles of Islamic Acts, the book that we all follow, the Tawzi al-Masail. And then he comes up on the list and we can look at him and try and follow him. Now, I'm going to stop over here, inshallah, we move to Masail. Tomorrow, we will continue this. And it's a very important subject. It's not a subject which some people may not understand it. Some people may find this very new. I want to say from now, if there is any confusion in this matter, if people are confused about what I am saying, then I ask you respectfully, don't ask people to send SMS messages threatening me. There's no purpose in that. Instead, I invite you, talk to the committee, give them the questions that you don't understand, the points that you do not understand. They will provide them to me, and I promise you, hand on heart, I will do my best to try and explain it in more detail, if necessary. I ask you respectfully to show me at least that much respect. So now, if we can have the light dimmed a little bit, please. Salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Sallallahu alayka ya Mawlai ya Aba Abdullah ya Shaheed ya Mazloom Karbala. My dear brothers and sisters, today we will remember a very important and a very special individual from the Shuhada of Karbala. His name was Hur. Hur was the commander of one of the armies, one of the battalions of Yazid. In the distance he could see the caravan of Aba Abdullah. And he knew that he had orders that were to prevent Aba Abdullah from getting to Kufa. The soldiers in his army were thirsty. It was hot. It was dry. The deserts of Iraq are brutal. The soldiers were feeling the heat. Their throats were parched. As the caravan of Aba Abdullah al-Hussein became closer and closer, Hur went to visit the Imam. Imam Hussein saw that Hur is thirsty from his face and from his complexion. And before anything, our beloved Imam made sure that Hur and his soldiers were given water and plenty of water. Hur then told Aba Abdullah that he couldn't let him continue to Kufa, that he couldn't take the road that led to Kufa. As a result, Imam Hussein was forced by Hur to take the road to Karbala, to the land known as Nainawa. Now take yourselves to the night of Ashura, my dear brothers and sisters. Ajarakumullah. It is the 9th of Muharram. It is the 9th of Muharram, can you imagine? The children of Ahlul Bayt are thirsty and are crying. You can hear the cries of Al-Atash, Al-Atash across the entire camp. Hur can hear these cries from his camp near the Furat, and he feels like he is in a dilemma. Hur is pacing up and down like a man possessed. He would look towards the camp of Imam Hussein and he would look down. He would look towards the camp of Imam Hussein and he would look down. He would look to the camp of Yazid and he would look down. He would take a step towards the camp of Imam Hussein and then come back and take a step towards the camp of Yazid and come back, pacing, worrying, with sweat flowing from his head and tears flowing from his eyes. One of his soldiers came to him and said, "Ya Hur, we know that you are one of the bravest generals in the army, but now we see you trembling and crying. You look worried and you look panicked, like someone who is making a choice between life and death." Hur looked at the soldier and sighed and he said, "My friend, I am faced with a choice that is very difficult to make. On the one side," and all of us should remember this choice, "on the one side, I see my life being good and long, but my hereafter being a disaster. And on the other side, I see my life is short, but I see my hereafter as having eternal salvation. I know that Yazid, la'anahum Allah, I know that Yazid wants to kill the son of Fatima, and I am a general in the army of Yazid. I know that joining with Hussein will mean that I am killed, because Yazid's forces will spare no one. I am caught between heaven and hell. As night fell and the soldiers went to sleep one by one, this is the 9th of Muharram. Hur was still awake, he was unable to sleep. He was pacing up and down, then tossing and turning. Then suddenly he knew what he had to do. It was like he knew. Everything suddenly became clear. He called his son and he called his servant quietly so that no one would guess what is happening. And the three of them went under cover of darkness towards the camp of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein. Hur was very shy to face the Imam, having been the person who blocked his way. Hur was very shy to face the Imam. He was the reason why the Imam was in Karbala. Hur asked his son to tie his hands to the back of his head like a captive. And then Hur walked slowly towards the tent of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein. Our beloved Imam asked his brother Abbas to go and meet Hur, telling Abbas, "Ya Abbas, our guest has arrived." On seeing this, Hur fell down to his knees, tears flowing from his eyes, ajrakumullah, and he begged the Imam for forgiveness. He asked the Imam to let him be the first one to go and fight the army of Yazid. Imam Hussein looked at Hur with love and affection and smiled at him, and he said, "Ya Hur, I have forgiven you already. Indeed, your mother named you Hur, which means free. And wallah, you are free in this world and in the akhirah. I consider you to be my honored and respected guest. I feel sad that I don't have any food or water to offer you." When the battle began on the morning of that fateful day of Ashura, the 10th of Muharram, Hur went into the battlefield with his son and his servant. He first talked to the army. After all, there were many who knew him. He gave some very powerful poetry, and the people who served under him knew. He tried to make them see sense. He tried to make them realize the error of their ways. Shimr ibn Zil-Joshan, la'anahumullah, realized that it was possible that some of those who knew Hur, especially those who were under him when he was a general and respected him, may be swayed by the words of Hur. Shimr told Umar ibn Sa'ad, la'anallah alayh, to send a group of soldiers to attack all of them together, not one by one as was the custom. Hur looked around and he saw a swarm of soldiers coming towards him. His son was the first to fall. His son fought valiantly though he was young, and he killed many of the enemy. After a while he was overcome and he entered the mercy of Allah. Shortly after, Hur's servant, who had always been loyal to him and was murdered by him and was murdered by the soldiers, fell. Finally, Hur was in the battlefield. He fought bravely, he fought gallantly. But after being surrounded and attacked and beaten by dozens of the enemy, imagine one man against dozens. One man being beaten by dozens. One mal'oon smashed the forehead of Hur with a blade, with a very sharp blade, and Hur fell from his horse. As he lay there bleeding at the last point in his life, he cried out, "Alayka minni salam, ya imami, ya Aba Abdullah." The Imam and Abul Fadl Abbas rushed to be with Hur, and Imam cleaned the blood from the forehead of Hur, and he took a handkerchief from his own qaba, and he tied it on the head of Hur to stop the bleeding. My brothers and sisters, can you bear this? And can you understand the maqam of Hur? That handkerchief was the handkerchief of none other than Fatima al-Zahra, salamullahi alayha. Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un, ridham bi qada'ihi wa tasneeman li amrih. Wa sayalamu alladhina zalamu ayyamun qalabin yanqalibun. Ya Allah, we ask you to accept our small ibadat. Ya Allah, we ask you to help us improve. Ya Allah, we ask you to help us increase our understanding and our ma'rifah of this beautiful gift of Islam that you have given us. Ya Allah, we ask you to help us understand and accept the ma'rifah of our beloved Imam Mahdi and the teachings that our beloved Imam Mahdi has given to us. Ya Allah, we ask you to help all of the Muslims, all of the mu'mins, all of the oppressed across the entire world, from the east to the west, who are being oppressed by the tyrants of today. Ya Allah, we ask you to remove and destroy and render nothingness for these tyrants of today. Ya Allah, we ask you to help our brothers and sisters in Pakistan, in Palestine, in Gaza, in Bahrain, in Syria, and across the entire world. Ya Allah, we ask you to protect Sayyid Hassan. Ya Allah, we ask you to protect all of our mujahideen. Ya Allah, we ask you to protect all of the mujahideen and the besieged and the sepah. Ya Allah, we ask you to protect our beloved leader, Imam Khamenei. Ya Allah, we ask you to protect all of our righteous maraji, Agai Sistani, Agai Makarim Shirazi, and all of the maraji, all of the righteous maraji. Ya Allah, please keep their shadow on us for as long as is possible. Ya Allah, give them long life and give them good health. Ya Allah, protect them from all sorts of problems and misfortunes. Ya Allah, please accept us. Without your acceptance, nothing has validity. Wa akhir da'wani alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.